I forgot to hit record on that one. It's all right. I got a backup. That's why I got a backup. In case my front up fails. All right. Oh, I think Eric found the link. Did he find the link? No, no. This is old. That's old. God dang it, Bobby. Well, so it's like a Star Wars movie here. You're being dropped right into the middle of the action. The action is I'm working with Garris, Eric Garris at antiwar.com. I'm trying to find the work that I have done previously proving that the New Republic supported every war since World War I. Now, I guess, you know, I don't know. Some of you know. I put all the links in Justin Raimondo's columns. You know, when you read Justin Raimondo's columns at antiwar.com, you think, boy, he sure does link to a lot of proof for everything. Yeah, well, I'm the one who puts all those links in there. And at one point, he made an assertion like, geez, these goons over at the New Republic, they must have supported every war in American history. Well, I went and I found the proof, and I linked to the essays. I found the articles. I did the research. I figured out who the hell was writing for them during Korea. And went and Googled the hell out of those guys. It took some digging, and I found it where the New Republic, that is the center left, that is JP Morgan, the Democrats, they have supported every war since World War I, World War I, World War II, Korea, and the entire Cold War umbrella of under which the Korean War and the Vietnam War, of course, fell. And then, to various degrees, I think I even linked to their support for Ronald Reagan's counter-revolutions in savage butchery murder in Latin America. And certainly they supported the First Gulf War, the Kosovo War, all the interventions in the Balkans in the 90s. And now they're on supporting their third Iraq War over there at the New Republic. The bastards. And the problem is, last night, Raimondo, he made that same assertion in his article, and I just went looking for his previous article, where I remember, with my brain, I did the work, I found the links. I linked, you know, word by word, 7 links in one sentence there, where he wrote, they must have supported every war in history, where I proved it. Follow the links, and it proves they supported all the wars, all of them. And then I can't find the goddamn Raimondo column. I don't even think Eric can find it. And it sucks because I think he could probably, he linked me this thing over here at SpartacusEducational.com where apparently they have, you know, some. You can obviously read Murray Rothbard on the New Republic and some of the wars. And you can, if you Google Raimondo and the New Republic, you can find him identifying their support for this and that and the other war at different times. Eric said he told me he just read that they had opposed Vietnam. Nuh-uh, man. I know. I found it. I went back and I Googled the crap out of it one day, say, I don't know, 4 years ago or something. And I proved that I showed that the New Republic supported the Vietnam War. Before they turned against it, of course, just like always, you know. All they do is monger them. It's not their responsibility to go die in them or anything like that. But anyway, it's nobody even cares. Who cares about the New Republic anyway, other than the Clintons? Yeah, the Clintons read it. So, it's a bunch of crap. Nobody reads the New Republic anyway. That's why the guy that bought it is now gutting it and fired everybody and is going to make a Huffington Post or a Gawker out of it. Good. And it's hilarious to watch on Twitter. I guess this is a very ridiculous inside baseball kind of a conversation. But, oh, over on the Twitter, boo-hoo-hoo for the New Republic. I'm with, what's his name? Is it Sam something? One of these guys said, my only problem is they didn't torch the place and pulp all the archives. That's what I'm saying. Sorry, whoever I'm plagiarizing. I can't remember your name. Sam Knight, I think, is who I'm plagiarizing there. Is that it? Or was that somebody else? That could have been somebody else that said that, actually. I can't freaking remember. Anyway, I'm stealing that line from someone. I'm not claiming it for my own ownership. Anyway, I agree. Yeah, and you know, and this is one of the last bastions of avowed white supremacy in America. The center-left Democratic Party, New Republic. Where they're happy to provide cover for Andrew Sullivan and his racial supremacy pseudoscience BS. And then, of course, were Martin Peretz and his lackeys talked about Arabs and compared them to animals and talked about how it ain't immoral to kill them because of how subhuman they are and et cetera like that. The pigs at the National Review, they can get away with a hell of a lot, but they can't talk about racial minorities like that. Not that Arabs in Arabia are a racial minority, but you know what I mean. They can't talk about people overseas in that stark of terminology, I don't think. But if you're a Democrat, you can get away with that crap. Anyway, so the New Republic is evil, and maybe one day I'll get back to Googling it. You know, it's like a word that you can't remember. What do you call that when it's too late to prosecute somebody? The statute of limitations. One time I couldn't remember statute of limitations. It drove me nuts. Well, this is like one of those, you know? It's like a word I can't remember. Which article was it? I gotta find it. Where I prove that the New Republic is guilty, guilty, guilty of warmongering. Alright. Anyway, who cares about that? Hey, guess what? I'm on in Manila, in the Philippines. Hi, Philippines. Holy crap, I didn't know I was on there. That's really cool. Sorry about my government killing you guys all the time. It makes me think I should interview the guy that wrote Benevolent Assimilation about the horrifying American war against the people of the Philippines back 110 years ago. Or 8 or 7. See how bad I am on Philippines history? America's crimes against the people of the Philippines are scarlet, man. Absolutely. Just make you not want to be from here anymore. But anyway, I'm very happy to be on the air there, and apologies for any current JSOC missions against your friends and neighbors. But happy to know that people are listening out there. I think that's great. Oh, good, and Sheldon's going to do it. Which means I only got one non-interview segment to talk coming up next. When I have to talk fast, I got a lot to cover. It's the Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at wholefoodcomplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at wholefoodcomplete.com.
Yeah, it occurred to me that maybe the New Republic article that Justin wrote about what jerks they are would have been right when they were attacking Ron Paul the worst in 2008. That's probably when it was, right around there. Anyway, I just would like to be able to show that. Not that anybody cares except me, but anyway.
All right, listen, so we got, luckily we got Sheldon coming up and to talk about the cops.
So that's good, because I got a lot to say about the cops myself, and I won't have enough time to say it all in this segment here. So we'll be able to continue the conversation with Sheldon. And then again, Ray McGovern on Eastern Europe and Phil Giraldi on the war, I guess especially in D.C. and Syria. I don't know. Anyway, and there's so much other news. Well, I'm going to talk about the wars with Phil now, I guess. Sorry. So let me just say about the cops that, first of all, I'm really excited to see people excited about this and see people care. One of the stresses of Facebook is seeing, if you have any libertarian friends at all, is just police abuse story after police abuse story. A Mike Brown a day. All day, every day. And if it's not outright murder, it's still just bashing some poor lady's skull in or raping her on the side of the road or God knows what. The cops are so out of control. And part of the worst part of it has been that nobody seems to care. Black people in America have virtually no political power. So they care, but they can't do anything about it. It takes, something like Garner being choked out on video that way. And
and the cop who did it to have a vowel at the end of his name, which makes him only kind of white. I guess. To make people kind of snap out of it a little bit. Mike Brown got them primed, and then Eric Garner's, the grand jury decision in the Eric Garner case, at least got the media, and therefore another huge segment of a percentage of the American population to, you know, sit up and take notice about this. And then the good and bad news, the bad and good news, is that the cops are going to keep killing people and killing people and killing people. And it's going to be really hard to make this die down. It's just like what happened with the Gaza war a few months back. Israel has always gotten away with saying, oh, boo-hoo, poor little us, as they massacre tiny little children to death for fun. Only this time, the witnesses who were right there were putting those pictures on Twitter. And there wasn't a damn thing that the Israelis could do about it. The people at Twitter were hitting retweet, 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 and the stuff was getting around. And, you know, Peter Jennings and Jennings and Brokaw, they're all dead. Not just Jennings. The day of that central control of the American people's narrative is over. And it is, because of Twitter, because of Facebook. And now this fire's been lit. The question is, what's going to happen? I think it's funny. I watched the debates about this, and I'm reminded of conversations we had so many years ago, where, you know, issues like whether cops are being trained to use the minimal amount of force necessary or absolute overwhelming force on all occasions is not even really being debated, right? They haven't been thinking about this in the mainstream media long enough at all to even start asking the right questions of, why is it that the cops are so much quicker to murder people now than before? People cry boo-hoo-hoo about 30 cops per year in America killed. In a nation of 300 million people, 30 cops a year killed. Well, when they kill well over 500 people a year, which is, you can count, more than one a day. And, of course, the stats are horrible, but it's clear. They're completely out of control. And so I've been like this since Waco. I mean, I already was like this, actually, because I already knew that Ronald Reagan was a dope pusher. I already knew that the most law and order people in America were, and the most drug warrior people in America were also the world's worst law-breaking criminal hypocrite drug dealers and drug dealer prosecutors in America. And I grew up on that truth. I just knew that since I was a boy. In the 1980s, I always knew that, and I always knew I hated cops from the time I got a skateboard when I was 11 years old. I decided that all cops are Nazis and they all ought to shoot each other in the face and leave us alone, you know, the rest of us alone. I've always hated them since, you know, my entire life. But then when Waco happened, I saw that they can murder, 90 people, 100 people, because after all, 6 Davidians were killed on the first day, right? So, they can murder 90 people 100 miles from my door, all civilians, all victims. None of them felons, none of them criminals. Not even their leader. And get away with it. And lie their asses off about it. And win over the people of the neighborhood to their side. As Bill Clinton said, oh, a bunch of religious fanatics murdered themselves. I don't know why that's any cop's fault. What are you talking about? When we know, of course, that Bill Clinton ordered the combat applications group, Delta Force, Team B, was there killing people and admitted it. Admitted it to Gene Cullen, the former CIA officer, admitted it to Stephen Barry, the former JSOC officer, that they had been there killing Davidians on the last day. It wasn't Janet Reno that ordered the highest tier special forces to kill the Branch Davidians. It was Bill Clinton who killed them. But anyway, so the American people's answer was, yay, we want to watch our daytime TV. So anyway, I've been stuck like this at least since then. Irreversible state hatred, abolitionist on the police issue since then. And it's nice to meet you. Guess what? Government is a monopoly, which means it's completely unaccountable. Poor services, high prices, no accountability, the same reason you hate all monopolies. That's why James Madison had to try to rig the little system of checks and balances, which, if you look at it now, the whole thing is just quaint and ridiculous and silly to look at. They felt compelled to pretend that they could somehow turn different departments of the government against each other. Because the admission in the first place is, this is a monopoly and they provide really bad services at really high prices with no accountability. And that's the problem. Anyway, more about that with Sheldon Richman in a minute. He's got the libertarian take. Just so you know, it's Mike Brown, Eric Garner. Tamir Rice is the 12-year-old boy who was shot in the stomach, and who they left there to die. Romain Brisbane is the man who was minding his own business when the cop assaulted him in Phoenix, Arizona 2 nights ago and killed him. Oh, I could have swore I thought he was reaching for a gun. You don't even carry a drop gun on you. I guess you don't have to, right? Oh, he reached for his waistband. Yeah, that's what everybody does when the cops say, put your hands up. They all reach for their waistband, especially people who don't have a gun. They all do that because they're trying to dare the cops to murder them. Don't you believe it? I mean, don't you believe it? And then there's Akai Gurley, murdered in New York. Again, they left him to die. Didn't even call the EMS. Just sat there and waited for him to bleed out. We're talking to the union rep by text messages while he was laying there bleeding to death. That's just from the last couple weeks. Few weeks. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West, while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal, as we knew it, is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right. First up today is our friend Sheldon Richman. He's about as libertarian as hell. He's the editor of The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. And writes there at fff.org and sheldonrichman.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Sheldon?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Whoa, you sound absolutely horrible. Please turn down maybe your mic input gain a little bit there.
Okay, hang on a second.
Yeah, so you're way up in the red. Boy, is Skype a trade-off, huh? All technology is a trade-off. That's just how it is. Anyway, so yeah, if you could possibly turn down that input, that'd help us out. Sheldon's got a new piece today, everybody. His TGIF. That doesn't mean what you think it means. It means the goal is freedom. And also it's sort of a Friday article he does every week for the Future of Freedom Foundation, FFF.org, the Ferguson distraction. Well, now tell me, Sheldon, what could possibly be nothing but a distraction about the crisis in Ferguson, Missouri?
Ah, that wasn't TGIF. I didn't think you were going to talk about that one.
It wasn't. I missed it. I didn't get your TGIF article. Well, this is the one that was in the email this morning. What the hell do I know?
That must be a day old. The Ferguson distraction.
Sorry. I don't know what your TGIF one was. I'll look at it while you're talking.
What I tried to point out in the Ferguson distraction is that, we have a continuing problem with the police throughout the country. To hang our evaluation of the problem on any single case is a huge mistake, because what happens is if people think the grand jury in St. Louis County did the right thing, then they think that means there's no problem that the rest of us complain about. On the other hand, if they had indicted Wilson, the officer Wilson, that would have been, for a lot of people, taken as proof that there is this problem. But it's really, however you evaluate that that case, and there's a lot of murkiness around it, right? You and I weren't there watching. We still have the problem nationwide, regardless of what the particular facts or the particular facts about Michael Brown and Darren Wilson are. We still have a problem. So we can't use that as the test of whether there's a problem or not. That's what happens with these celebrated cases, right? The case of the week becomes everything gets hung on it. Mm-hmm. And it's just, that's just a big mistake.
Well, but here's the thing about that though, is there's a new one every couple of days or so, and it's not going to stop just, like that either.
Right,
so if people want to make a cause celeb out of this one or the other one, it's keeping it in the news and, you know, count to 10 and there will be breaking news. A cop in another city shot another unarmed black man.
Yeah, which has its own particular facts. And people will just do the same thing over and over again. So it doesn't end up helping those of us who are trying to get across that there is this systemic problem. We need to
I guess I'm kind of disagreeing a little bit in saying that you have people rally around this one case. And, of course, in the case of Michael Brown, the reason that it became such a big deal in the first place was because when a few people started milling around grumbling, they called out the 3rd Infantry Division.
Oh, sure.
You know, to put down the riot when there was no riot, and the whole world went, whoa, 1,000 times the militarist crackdown necessary for the scale of the peaceful protest.
Sure.
About what had happened.
Oh, yeah.
So that was what made it a big deal, but it brought the whole subject to prominence where now everybody's talking about police abuse like we see on our Facebook feeds. It's now the entire national conversation. And even though people are saying, yeah, but what about this about Mike Brown? Okay, well, what about Eric Garner? Well, what about Tamir Rice? What about Rubane Brisbane? What about Akai Gurley? What about, and there's going to be, the cops are killing some guy right now. And he's, and so, when people try to dismiss the one cause celeb, they really can't, because there's another one right there ready always. It's not going away anytime soon either. And yet, by latching on to the particular cases, it has helped, you know, bring the subject to a much higher level of prominence in the national discussion, right?
No, I'm not saying we shouldn't be talking about it. We should be talking about it, but I'm just saying we shouldn't hang it on any given case, because a lot of these cases are always going to be somewhat murky. I mean, it's far clearer in the case of Eric Garner than, say, in the case of Michael Brown.
Right.
And then people also then start looking at the particular personalities involved, which is a mistake.
Right. The search for the perfect victim.
Brown certainly had his own problems. Garner less so. I mean, Garner, his runs in with the law have all been you know, so-called victimless crimes. I mean, I should say victimless so-called crimes. You know, selling loose cigarettes, having marijuana, giving a false name to the police. I mean, he didn't strong arm anybody. He didn't steal anything from people. All he did was deprive the New York government of revenue, and that's not a crime. That's a virtue. Everybody should be trying to do that if you live in New York or your own respective cities and states. I just think if it becomes personality attached, then it weakens the case. And look what's happening. People blame militarization. Sure, there was the police had an ugly display after the Darren Brown Darren Wilson Michael Brown incident. It was outrageous. What the police did, threatening totally innocent people, just standing there, reporters, weren't creating any kind of harm. And we fixed now on the militarization of the police, which of course is a huge issue. And I agree, the police departments shouldn't be acquiring such stuff. But, you know, long before there was militarization of police, cops were beating people with rubber hoses and billy clubs. So you don't need militarization to have huge brutality incidents, whether racial or not. And you don't even need victimless crime laws, as I point out in the article. People have been arrested and beaten and I assume one place or another killed because a cop gets it in his head, because he doesn't like the person, that he's casing some store to rob. Okay, that has nothing to do with drugs or guns or victimless crimes. So they don't need that stuff. It does make it easier, but they don't need that stuff. So if we fixate on that stuff, we're really missing the core problem. The core problem is the model of policing, right? This top-down occupation army model of policing. That's the real problem.
All right. Now
that gets lost, I think, in these individual cases.
Yeah. And you know what? I want to get back into all that in the second segment here. I'm very interested in it, and I really want to give you a chance to explain, you know, what you think could be good ideas for other ways of doing things. But I want to ask you, and you do talk about this in your article, too, about what all race has to do with it. Because, of course, cops do kill white people all the time, too. They kill everybody all the time, although it sure looks like, you know, the old days of Jim Crow to black people, and obviously, proportionally, they get it much worse. But I wonder, you know, I see a lot of people saying, well, race is a red herring in this. It's all just about the state versus the people. But I guess I don't see any black people saying it's just a red herring.
Yeah, I get distracted from a second. Give me the tail end of that.
Well, I just want you to say something smart about race and police abuse what it all means these days. I mean, I don't know what to make of it all. And I see people, I guess, kind of dismissing. I see white people dismissing race as the problem. And I see black people and I guess others looking at it through their eyes, seeing it as purely a racial issue. And whereas you and I look at it as from a libertarian government monopoly issue and this kind of thing, you know?
Well, look, as usual, it's complicated. I know it's easy to say that, but I think we always have to keep it in mind. These things are complicated. Race is definitely a huge factor. I don't want to underplay it. I think there is a systemic racism that is the vestige of American history. I know that conservatives like to dismiss that, and I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong to do that. I think mixed in with that, and it's hard to distinguish, is this occupation army model and mentality. The fact that the cops are enforcing victimless laws against victimless crimes is also part of it. I think in the case of Eric Garner, it wasn't purely race. I think they would have done the same thing. It's class too. They would have done the same thing to a poor white guy who was depriving the city of revenue from the cigarette tax. I think that was more about revenue than race in that case.
Right. All right, hold it right there. We got to take this break. I always ask a big question right before a damn break. Right back after this. ScottHorton.org, LRN.FM. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show, y'all. You know, Sheldon does have a TGIF today. It's called Tackling Straw Men is Easier Than Critiquing Libertarianism. Hey, you got that right. I hardly ever see a liberal or a leftist actually criticize libertarianism. The closest thing I can even think of to that was a hardcore, serious-ass Marxist communist economist arguing a very technical point with Hans Hermann Hoppe. And I thought, wow, well, they're at least having an honest discussion. You won't find nothing like that at Salon.com. But anyway, so we're talking about the cops with the great Sheldon Richmond from the Future Freedom Foundation. And you had me at get rid of the current system entirely, Sheldon, but replace it with what?
Well, I can't exactly specify with what. I want some spontaneous bottom-up form of governance. And just like I couldn't, I can't tell you what a proper computer industry would look like in a completely free market, because there's too much that's going to emerge spontaneously. By people thinking up things on the spot that I can't hear think of, you know, because I'm not in this situation. I can't tell you what proper policing should look like. I think what we have to do away. I know what we don't like, what we shouldn't like, and that's this top-down occupation army model. People are increasingly seeing the police, and not just in poor areas. It may be more pronounced in poor areas, but it's true, I think, across the spectrum, as the police they're watching you. Nobody feels comfortable to see a policeman in the rear view mirror, because there's too much you can be gotten on, right? There are too many laws, obviously, that have, first of all, many so-called laws that address things which in no way aggress against other people or their property, but yet you can be held, responsible and then have a fine, be forced to pay a fine or worse. We know specifically in New York City that they have this policy, the so-called broken window policy, which means you go after very small things. And this is somehow supposed to discourage large crimes. And the theory comes from the name. It was identified by the sociologist, conservative sociologist, criminologist, social scientist named Banfield some years ago. I think The Unheavenly City was his book, where he decided that if you have an abandoned building and people are allowed to, kids are allowed to throw stones at the windows and break them, and if nothing happens, you're going to end up getting, you know, rapes and murders in the neighborhood. And so the idea was crack down on these little things. And that way you'll prevent the big things. Well, that has been translated into going after somebody like Eric Garner for selling Lucy's. By the way, I love Lucy's, which means untaxed, you know, loose untaxed cigarettes, individual cigarettes, less than a pack of cigarettes, and going after people that do things like that, which are obviously totally harmless. There can't be any sales of loose cigarettes unless they're willing buyers. And as everybody knows, smuggling of cigarettes is a big thing in New York City because the tax is so high. The tax is about half the price of a pack. And a pack is like 12 bucks or 13 bucks a pack now. So, people smuggle cigarettes in from North Carolina, and people, low income people like Eric Garner, make some money by selling cigarettes to willing buyers. Now, who doesn't like this? Well, the people that rely on the tax revenues. The politicians don't want to see him, somebody like Garner erode those revenues. And the licensed retailers who are don't mind charging $12 or $13 don't want to see it either. So they rat out people like Garner. And then the mayor and the other politicians in New York City have told the police to crack down on people like this. That's why this happened. I do think this was more about revenue than race. Yeah. We have to stop this. And getting rid of victimless crime laws will help, although police, like I said, can use other pretexts to harass people and beat up people and kill people.
Let me interrupt for just one moment to say, Sheldon, that I saw Rand Paul said something a lot like that, that the taxes are so high, they've created this black market, then they're out persecuting this guy collecting the taxes. And John Stewart said, well, that's effing ridiculous, although he didn't explain why it was. And then that made the headline at the Ross story. And so every liberal on Twitter and Facebook, at least on Twitter, they're all passing this around and everybody agrees. And it was funny, like every negative adjective you could possibly think of that they're using against Rand Paul, for being, you know, basically every synonym for crazy, lunatic, you know, detached from reality, whatever, all the ones I can't think of off the top of my head.
Yeah,
and yet, all he said was the plain truth. And they don't even have an argument or try to make one.
Look,
that's what they were doing, was enforcing this petty law on this guy to death.
They like cigarette taxes. That's the chic progressive position. We have to have high cigarette taxes, which is really odd because they would all be upset if all cigarette smokers quit tomorrow and the money wasn't flowing in so the politicians could play games. They would be very upset. In other words, they need people to smoke so they can get that revenue. So they like cigarette taxes. They like so-called progressives, phony men of the people like de Blasio. And so they don't want to see that attacked. I was told on Facebook that I should not be saying this. Why? Because Ann Coulter has said it. That's the new standard. So, you know, a broken clock is right twice a day. So if I say the same thing that Ann Coulter or Limbaugh says, who I disagree with on practically everything else, then the position must fall.
Let me give Limbaugh credit.
Well, your audio just got terrible on us, Sheldon.
Yeah, at the top of his show, and I figured he was going to be blasting.
Wait, Sheldon, can you hear me? Hey,
he's over at Carter.
Your audio got terrible on us.
Was doing just that. So I figured, okay, we're going to hear more of it from Limbaugh. He stung me. It was an amazingly sympathetic discussion of Garner. Garner's a low-income guy trying to make some money. The tax is what allows this black market to exist. Blah, blah, blah. The government is telling the police to crack down on people like Eric Garner. He got it right. Why can't people admit that? I'm no fan of his. Like I said, I disagree with just about everything he says. But what's wrong with this position? Show me in logic what's wrong with the position.
They can't. They don't even try. And, you know, another thing, another big a point of dissonance on the left this week, Sheldon, is how the guy that filmed Garner's murder was indicted, but they don't ever say why. All the liberals go, oh my God, can you believe it? The cop skates, but the guy that filmed it is indicted, but they don't ever mention why. He was indicted on a gun possession charge, which they love. And so they shut up. And same for John Stewart. They shut their mouth right at the part where they name the charge that he got nailed on. You know, just because liberals suck. Sorry for the dead air there. I should come up with a question for you.
Yeah, I lost you. But I think I hear you now.
Yeah, yeah, your audio got terrible on us there for a minute, but it sounds like you're back. So I don't know if you could hear any of that, but I didn't really phrase it in the form of a question.
I didn't hear that. It sounded like my system blacked out. But
oh, okay. Well, I was mocking the liberals for omitting the charge that the Garner murder cameraman was nailed on. It was a gun possession charge. And so even John Stewart and every other liberal is saying, oh my God, they've indicted the guy that filmed the murder, but not the murderer. But they stop at naming the charge. And the charge is he was carrying a gun without permission from the man.
Mm. Right.
And that's because liberals are as dishonest as conservatives. Bastards.
Right. It's frustrating because they have all these, I think they're sort of mental blocks. They can't criticize. They can't lay any, you know, responsibility to de Blasio. Why? Because his image he's a man of the people. He's a progressive. He ran to the left of other people in New York City. And the same thing, you know, they can't say anything bad about the cigarette tax because that's a progressive thing. So we can't find any, bad consequences from such things. But let them talk. Let them spell out their case. I mean, Jeffrey Toobin tried to take that on too yesterday, and it was pathetic. All he said was, yeah, but wait a second. Rand Paul didn't point out that we need to discourage people from smoking. Well, what's that got to do with it? Even if that's true, Rand Paul's analysis there was right, that the tax is very high, and every time the tax goes up, smuggling increases. It's a very old story. You can go back in the New York Times and find stories dating back for years about smuggling in New York City. And
hey, this is what caused something else. The Boston Tea Party was over there.
Early Americans sided with the smugglers against the customs agents. That used to be an honorable profession in the United States. Before it was the United States, and probably even after that, even after it became a country. The smuggler was an honorable person. He was getting around tariffs and other trade restrictions in order to serve consumers.
All right, now, I'm sorry. I got us too sidetracked here. I really wanted to get back to at least, you know, some ideas for how to move forward. And we're going to run out of time for this segment. Sorry to the live audience. But, Sheldon, if it's okay, I want to keep you at least another couple of minutes and ask you to talk about, you know, when you propose some kind of alternative system to the current state of occupation by county and city government jurisdiction and state government jurisdiction the way we have it now. Are you talking about once we get to anarcho-capitalist paradise, or you're saying under our current system of 50 states and these lousy constitutions that, you know, maybe we could do this, that, or the other thing? I know liberals listening are going to assume, well, no, I assume that liberals listening assume that what you mean is you think that the local governments should hire private police agencies, like Pinkerton thugs, to be our overlords instead of the local sheriffs that we vote for. No. Is that what you think?
No, I'm not talking about the central government. And by central, I include like a city government is central for that city. I don't mean hiring, privatizing. Look, the New Left used to talk about decentralized community-based policing in the 60s. And libertarians were right there. Carl Hess and Murray Rothbard and others were picked up on that and wrote about it. It should be devolved down to the local communities. I mean, I heard Ben Carson the other day say, a guy who some conservatives like to see run for president, say the police are our friends. He said without the police, people would be coming into our homes saying, hey, I like that TV, I think I'll take it. Well, he missed a couple of points there. One is the police already take our private property through asset forfeiture, right? Civil asset forfeiture. And on the other hand, when some private person comes in and takes our TV set, the police are pretty impotent anyway. So, you know, you fill out a form and go out and buy a new TV set or call your insurance company if you have insurance. The police aren't going to find it. So the idea is to decentralize policing down to the community level and let people figure out their own solutions to this. The top down is not a good solution. We can see it now. And policing is fairly new. As I mentioned at the end of the article, London didn't get the bobbies until, about a third of the way into the 19th century. So I think we could say, okay, we tried it. It failed. Now let's do something else.
Right. Just got to zoom out, take a little bit bigger picture, look at it. Cause yeah, you're right. I mean, it seems also inevitable the way the system is now. And you know, you mentioned this before, and in fact, you mentioned it in the context of it not being the end all solution because it is only part of it. But it seems like drug prohibition is at the root of so much of this. And that, you know, it's like with the seen and the unseen. If we hadn't had a war on drugs since Richard Nixon and then especially Ronald Reagan all this time, how might society be? How might the relationship between communities and their cops be different than they are now, between especially minority right. groups and the cops and this kind of thing? It's just, there's no way to measure the level of unnecessary grief and destruction and destabilization that has been caused in our society by the war on drugs.
Right. Yeah. I don't mean to. And when I said the police could beat up people without that, I didn't mean to downplay.
Sure. I know. I mean, that's why I brought it back up, because it was in a different context. Like I said,
all you have to do is watch The Wire, which was written by a former cop. The producer, I think, is a director, former policeman. Very realistic. It's the police in the war on drugs is an occupying army. There's no doubt about that. And here's what's important about the war on drugs. We call it a victimless crime. And so, you know, the other side will say, what do you mean victimless? The families suffer, when the breadwinner gets involved in drugs and maybe gets strung out on drugs. By victimless crime, we don't mean that nobody's affected by drug use. People, third parties are affected by private conduct all the time. That does not involve aggression or force, therefore is not legally actionable. What we mean by victimless is a more technical term. It's a point Randy Barnett makes, a legal law professor and libertarian. It means there's no complaining witness, right? When a drug transaction is occurring, the buyer and the seller want to be in the transaction by definition. So if the police are going to, so neither one is going to complain. The buyer's not going to say, hey, that guy just sold me drugs, go arrest him. That doesn't make any sense. So the police, if they're going to figure out or find these transactions, the police have to have informants, and they have to spy, and they have to disguise themselves and wiretap and all that other stuff, all the stuff that leads to the horrors of policing. So that's the essential characteristic, that the police are going to have to use rotten tactics to find things that, because people want to do the things. It's not like if someone mugs somebody else, the victim goes to the police. You don't need to. They do sometimes, but you don't need to go undercover as a potential victim to find muggers, because the people will complain and identify the mugger, because the person doesn't want to be in that transaction, quote unquote. But it's not the case in terms of voluntary sales of guns, sales of drugs, sales of untaxed cigarettes, untaxed alcohol, whatever the case may be. So the police have to become spies. And they have to abuse people, and they have to threaten people in order to get them to be informants, and threaten them with charges, or threaten their mothers with charges if you don't come and help us. All that nasty, nasty stuff that creates animosity between the police and the people in those communities, and that leads to the kinds of horrors that we've been seeing, and that's what we have to end.
Right. All right. Well, thanks very much for coming back on the show, Sheldon. Good to talk to you again.
Okay, my pleasure. Anytime, Scott. Thanks.
All right, y'all, that's the great Sheldon Richman. He's the vice president of the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org. Subscribe to their journal, The Future Freedom. It's just $15 a year to read it online, $25 a year to get it in the mail. It's a nice little pamphlet, man. You'll like it, or a little booklet kind of thing. It's good. The Future Freedom, he's the editor of it. And, again, FFF.org. Back in just a sec. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is our friend Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst for 27 years, expert on the former Soviet Union. He's now a peacenik, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And he regularly gives talks at local groups around the country about peace. You can find out about that by way of a group called It's Tell the Word, right, Ray? Welcome back to the show.
That's correct.
Right.
Thought I had. Yeah, you can look on my website, raymcgovern.com.
That's what I was just going to say. You can also find what Ray writes at consortiumnews.com, Bob Perry's site. And Ray and Bob both have spent this whole year and more, this whole last year and more, being good on Ukraine and America and American relations with Russia and the crisis over Ukraine. So if you want to know, you want to catch up, you go to consortiumnews.com, search Ukraine there, and you will learn what you need to know. And as the spotlight on antiwar.com today points out, it's this piece by Patrick L. Smith, who we talked to earlier this week. New York Times propagandists exposed. Finally, the truth about Ukraine and Putin emerges. And he gives Perry credit there and Consortium News credit in that article. And he talks about how now that Henry Kissinger has finally started speaking honestly in this interview with Der Spiegel, and then the Washington Post published this article by Katrina Vandenhuevel, which we're also running today at antiwar.com, that this is now basically amounts to the mainstream admitting that Ray and Bob were right all along, that America picked this fight, that their narrative of revitalized Russian Empire on the march is false. Is that pretty much the same way you read that, Ray?
Well, thanks for giving Bob and me, Bob and Ray, the old comedy team, some credit here.
You deserve a lot of it. No, seriously. I mean, the entire narrative on Earth would have been much fuzzier if it hadn't have been for the clarity that you guys have provided.
Well, that may be so, Scott, but we're just as worried as ever. I talked to Bob this morning. He was appreciative of getting all that good publicity and all that hope that's provided by the notion that even the mainstream press, so-called, in this country is starting to turn. Now, the same can be said, by the way, of the press in Germany, and that's a good sign. But it's dwarfed in significance by what the House did yesterday. My God, there's a declaration of war, pretty much, against Russia. And, if I'm Putin and I'm sitting back there in the Kremlin, I'm saying, my God, what's going on here? I'm not going to take any solace from some marginal increase in insanity in the Western press. I'm going to look at what the House has done and what this fellow Breedlove there, curious name, Breedlove, sort of like Dearlove, the old MI6 head. Breedlove is, shaking the sabers. And so if I were Russian, I would be very, very perturbed. I would be very, very much on the defensive. And yet, in Putin's speech yesterday, he starts right off by saying, I appreciate the support of the Russian people for a mature reaction to what's going on in the Ukraine. And,
let me stop you there for a second, Ray, and ask you to, if you could please elaborate about this resolution that was passed by the House. declaration of war. That's a pretty strong term. What it reminds me of, actually, is the Iraq Liberation Act of 1998 that Bill Clinton signed under pressure from the PNAC crew, that Ron Paul at the time called it a virtual declaration of war. This guarantees that sooner or later we're going to invade Iraq, probably in the next administration, he said on the floor in 98. And is that this same kind of thing?
Well, it is, but it's insanity. I mean,
Iraq, Saddam actually didn't have weapons of mass destruction he could fight back with.
But Russia does. I mean, you know, it is beyond the pale. Now, the president, of course, would have to sign any act like that, and I don't know how it would fare in the Senate. Presumably, the Senate would lockstep approve it.
But what really does it say there?
Well, it says that the U.S. should be ready to move things onto an operational level here for U.S. missile strikes or whatever, permanently basing NATO forces in countries on the on the Russian periphery like Poland, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, stockpiling a base in Poland with enough weapons to, you know, rapid deployment of thousands of troops against Russia. That's a direct quote. Well, this is a blitzkrieg scenario is what they're calling it. And, you know, what this brings to mind is the incredible contrast between all this rhetoric and now some movement on the ground and Putin and his advisors' approach, which I have to say, I agree with him when he defines it as mature. And that comes of the fact that this is their backyard. They hold all the important cards with respect to the Ukraine, including some very, very powerful economic cards. And so what is particularly impressive to me, having watched Russia and the Soviet Union for 50 years now, is that, thank God, if I could say it that way, we have some maturity in the Kremlin. They're going to watch the Senate and the House hoisted on their own petard, because no one, not even Breedlove in their right mind, is going to challenge Russia militarily, because if they do, they realize that this would involve the most acute crisis since the Cuban Missile Crisis. That was in 1962. It could happen again.
Man, yeah, you know, Eric Margolis said he spoke with Russian diplomats in France, and they said they couldn't think of a higher state of tension between America and Russia since then, since Kennedy and the almost war over the missiles in Cuba, which even if that's hyperbole, hell, coming from them, it's worth taking into account that that's the kind of language they're using. You know, maybe Reaganite brinksmanship got worse at one point or another. I don't know.
Well, it's the perception. Now, for example, everything is thrown at the Russians here in this act as though it were fact. I'll say again, as though it were fact that the Russians are responsible for downing that Flight 17 over Ukraine. That is far from clear. My guess is that I've looked at a lot of the evidence. It's more than a guess, is that the Russians were not responsible for that. It was the Ukrainians. And there's lots of circumstantial evidence to suggest that. But here, the House just says, well, because the Russians were responsible for downing the airliner. So everything is thrown into the kettle here. Now, if one adopts some perspective and looks back to the old KAL-007 event where an American plane was downed in over Siberia, well, there was propaganda hay made out of that by the Reagan administration, but it was just a couple of years before people came to their senses and some very sound strategic arms limitation talks took place, and it prepared the way for Gorbachev and George H.W. Bush, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the unique opportunity, I say unique in my lifetime, of a genuine peace, as George H.W. Bush put it, a Europe complete and free from Portugal to the Ural Mountains. And that, of course, was squandered as soon as NATO and the U.S. and Germany violated their promise not to move NATO to the Russian border. So when you put this into perspective, these things do go in waves. I don't think Obama has completely lost it, although I wish he'd speak out earlier than he does. But I think Obama and his advisors realize how close they're coming to really provoking Russian reaction.
Yeah. All right. Well, hold it right there, Ray. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with the great Ray McGovern. RayMcGovern.com, ConsortiumNews.com.
Hey, all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I got Ray McGovern on the line, former CIA analyst. We're talking about the aftermath of America's coup in Ukraine and the breakdown of America's relationship with Russia since then. Now, where we were interrupted by the break there, Ray, you were talking about, I think, something along the lines of the president understanding just how much jeopardy his State Department has put, you know, the world in, what a precarious position they put his government in. But I think my question then is, so what? What does Obama have to do with it anyway? The fact that, I think it's probably even right that, you know, Hillary picked Nuland. Maybe he could have overruled it, but he didn't. But then, you know, it's plausible to me that this whole kind of coup went off with him barely taking note of it or even necessarily being in the loop on it or whatever. The whole thing blew up in everybody's face. But then again, how much power does the president really have anyway to change it? It sounds like, you know, there are so many vested interests, powerful ones, who would like to have a Cold War. Obviously, no one wants a hot one, but who would like to have a Cold War with Russia. Is there any force that can stop them? All the generals and all the admirals and all the promotions they could get, all the procurement officers and all the money that they can take under the table, all the congressmen who are going to get, you know, reelection money in both parties from the military-industrial complex and all that. It sort of seems like, sort of like going back into Iraq. It's just on. There ain't, what's Obama going to do about it? You know, better keep his bubble top up if he wants to even try to stop him. But I don't even see where he's trying to, really.
Well, that's the big question, Scott. One thing that can be established is that Obama has very little backbone. He's getting some good advice from some people who know which end is up. But the sophomores, those real tough ladies, Samantha Power and Susan Rice, they seem to have him intimidated, actually. And so they'll go along with this kind of draft legislation and leave it up to him in the end to veto it. Now, this is very serious stuff. General Dempsey, who prevented a war back in September of
this
last year.
This is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest ranking military officer. Right.
Now, I think he's hanging in there just so that he can prevent worse things from happening. He's already questioned the president about boots on the ground. You know, there are 6,000 boots on the ground already, if you count two for each soldier, right? Is my math right? So 6,000 boots, and it's going to be more. Dempsey doesn't see where this all ends, to paraphrase Petraeus's famous remark. And so he is a voice for caution. Surely.
Are you sure about that? Because it seems like Obama's the one saying, no, really, no boots. And he means special forces and advisors, but no actual troops, no infantry to fight battles. Maybe help lead them, wink, wink, that kind of thing. But then Dempsey's the one saying, hey, listen, we might need troops. And I have an open mind about that. And I might just recommend that to the president when and if I feel like.
Now, that's exactly right. What you're hearing from Obama, however, is political rhetoric. What you're hearing from Dempsey is a man who knows that he owes the Congress of the United States, representing us people, as well as the president, his best military judgment. And so he is undermining the rhetorical posture, the political posture of the administration, by saying, look, my job as the chief military officer of this government is to tell Congress, as well as the president, there's going to have to be boots on the ground, okay? And he says, no, the question really is, whose boots? And that's a feckless question, because we know that Petraeus and the other generals bragged about training up and equipping some 300,000 Iraqis and many Afghans. And look at the chaos. Look what happened when the so-called Islamic State shot some AK-47s in their direction earlier this year. They all fled. They ran away. Four divisions, Scott. Well, I exaggerate. They didn't all run away. The officers took helicopters out of the area. You know? And so what happened? Well, they left their tanks, they left their armored personnel carriers, they left their artillery behind. So what do we do? Well, obviously we had to destroy them, all that equipment, billions of dollars of worth of equipment for four divisions, so that ISIL or the Islamic State or Daesh or whatever we call it these days wouldn't get them. Now, who profiteers from that? Well, the people who make the weapons, now they can sell billions of dollars of war weapons to Iraq, yeah. And that's what's happening. So it is the military, industrial, congressional, security services, and media complex. Yeah. Now, media is important. And so let me go back to that and say, if I were Putin and I had seen the media blackout on what the House did yesterday, man, I would have some real questions as to what's going on in America.
Yeah.
When the House votes for essentially for giving the president war power to wage war against the other superpower in the world, and they still are with nuclear weapons, and the press is told not to say anything about that, I would be really worried if I were Putin. I also am worried by this missile defense business, which is authorized in this draft legislation, and which Putin has made clear. What he said way back last spring was, you know, our decision to accept Crimea back into Russia proper was, you know, partly due to the notion that that NATO might incorporate Ukraine, but even more weighing on our decision was the missile defense system, which is being installed in and around Europe, and we didn't want that to be deployed unhindered in the Black Sea. And so, since a lot of these missile defense so-called systems are being put on ships now, because Bobby Gates thought that was a real clever way to get around the Czechs and the Poles and the others who didn't want it on their territory, so that was a major factor. What the Russians want to avoid is giving the United States armed forces the impression that they can take out their strategic deterrent in a first strike. Now, that hasn't been a concern since the ABM Treaty in 1972, and I remember that quite well because I was in Moscow for that. That was the big deal that put restrictions not only on defensive systems but on offensive systems. Now that has all gone by the board. Bush exited from the ABM treaty. And what Putin and his advisors are worried about is that the U.S. forces will get it into their head that with this missile defense system, they will be free to mount the kind of first strike that has given everybody the bejeebies ever since 50 years ago. So That's really important. Putin came back to that in his speech yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, that just means the Russians have to put their nukes on an even lighter hair trigger in reaction.
Yeah, the technical term is launch on warning, right?
Right, yeah.
So you get a little warning that a missile has been shot from a ship in the Black Sea.
What's a few H-bombs between friends, Ray? It's not that big of a deal. I'm sorry. Music's playing. We got to go. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I sure appreciate it. Talk to you again soon, Ray. That's funny, man. The music interacts with some Skypes different than others. We'll be right back, y'all, with Phil Giraldi in just a sec. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. That's where I keep all my interview archives. More than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003. Join up the chat room during the show if you want. scotthorton.org/chat. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. All right, enough. Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA officer. He is the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, the America lobby in Washington, D.C. And he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. The latest there is Neocons Triumphant in Washington and Geneva. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing? Oh, I hit the wrong dang button. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How about you?
I'm doing good. Sorry, I've been using Skype all day. That's a different button altogether. Okay. Very happy to have you on the show. Now, so here's how I set up this conversation. Got ourselves a new Secretary of Defense. It was announced today. Well, he ain't confirmed yet, but soon will be. Ashton Carter to replace Chuck Hagel, who was forced out. And when it comes to the reasons that Hagel was forced out, all this stuff I've read about it is all very vague, really. It sounds like, oh, personality conflicts, and he didn't get along with this person or that person. But nobody seems to want to really shoot straight about, I mean, it seems like it was tied up in the Syria thing. But it wasn't clear whether, you know, who was the more of the hawk, Obama or Hagel, or who was more for the insane policy of attacking the Bashar al-Assad regime at the same time that he is actually the strongest force on the ground fighting the Islamic State, which we're also fighting. Was it Obama is the crazy one or Hagel is the crazy one? I know it was the neocons were against nominating him in the first place, bad, but...
Well, that's a tough question to answer. I've heard a number of different things on this. It seems that the only thing everybody agrees on was that there was a major conflict between Hagel and Susan Rice, National Security Advisor, over Syrian policy. And what I've been told is that essentially Hagel wasn't really coming down on one side or the other in terms of what to do, but he insisted that we have clarity in terms of what the plan is. And he was basically saying that the Pentagon, his people in the Pentagon, which means uniformed military officers, the senior level, were very concerned that there was no well-defined mission with real objectives and with any real plan for getting, first of all, success and for getting out of it. And this is the viewpoint, essentially, that Hagel was representing, according to what I've heard, which to me makes a lot of sense. And so anyway, he was out of the loop in terms of the White House, which was basically in managing this this war, you know, and essentially saying, oh, well, this has happened today, so tomorrow we'll do this. And Hagel was objecting to the whole way this thing was being run by kind of a, you might refer to it as a kitchen cabinet, the people really close to Obama, which is Susan Rice, which is, what's her name at the UN. And, so the inner circle really was the one with Obama were the ones kind of running this, and Hagel was left out on a limb on it. And that's the view apparently he was expressing.
Okay, but see, I'm still terribly disappointed in what you just said, because here's why. I think you're right. I mean, it makes perfect sense. Don't get me wrong. But I mean that what you're saying, though, I think, is that it's not that he said, look, we can either be – obviously, non-intervention isn't one of the options. But it's not that he said, look, we can either fight the Islamic State and pretty much leave Assad alone and or maybe work with him to fight the Islamic State and reestablish the borders of Syria, maybe work on a political transition after that, or we can do this completely crazy plan that the Weekly Standard wants us to do, where we train up an army of so-called moderates that then is supposed to take on Nusra and ISIS and Hezbollah and the Syrian state army backed by the Russians, which is completely crazy and stupid. But what you're saying is not even that he was really saying, okay, here are our choices, which are we doing, but that he was even just saying, like, hey, does anybody have any idea what we're doing at all? It wasn't even, like, he didn't even want to define the choices as well as I just defined them, even though that's more or less what they're talking about up there.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that. I think basically what he was saying was he wanted clarity in terms of what are we doing. And, you know, he was willing, as a good soldier in this context, he was quite willing to attack Syria. That's what I've heard. Or at least view Syria as an opponent in this rather than as a helper. And do what he could possibly along the line of that policy. But the fact was he wasn't even giving clear directions on that. He was basically, the White House was basically saying, oh, we favor regime change in Syria. They've been saying that for years now. But the fact is, what does that mean? What does that mean when you're fighting an active war on Syrian territory and you don't have any real guidelines in terms of what you're doing or not doing and how you're going to do it? And this is what Hegel was basically objecting to, as I understand it.
Right. Well, and it seems like that's no different than the entire chaos in all of D.C. I had missed it myself, but Eric Garris at antiwar.com told me he saw a Republican senator was actually asked by a reporter. This would be the first time somebody asked this on cable news probably in 4 years. Well, geez, who's supposed to come after Assad once the Ba'ath regime falls and all that? And the answer was, well, you know, we're just going to have to hope that someone will come to the fore.
Like, yeah, I think it was Sessions or somebody who asked that question. You're absolutely right. And that's exactly what the way it played out. You know, what are we going to do when he goes down? Or what is the plan for after, you know, Assad? And there was no answer.
And this is 3 years into the thing, which is funny because, you know, I mean, I've been talking with you since 2005. And I guess with Margulies since 2004, we've talked about David Wurmser and the neocon plans for Syria all this time, right? And we've been saying rhetorically all this time, I guarantee it's in the archives from 9 years ago, Phil, where we're talking about, yeah, but who's supposed to come after Assad? The Muslim Brotherhood, if they're lucky, those will be the moderates. And then it'll be Al-Qaeda to their right.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yep.
Okay,
yeah,
so
that's exactly what it is. I mean, the fact is they keep and in fact, if you read over the newspapers the last 2 weeks, you're getting all kinds of contradictory accounts that are clearly being leaked by the White House in terms of how this war is even going. There was something like 2 weeks ago saying that there has been no significant erosion of ISIS as a result of all these bombing attacks. And now we had, I don't know who was, Dempsey or somebody a couple of days ago saying, oh, yeah, they've seriously been hurt. I mean, who's telling the truth here and what is the truth?
Right. You know, I was talking with Chris Woods, author of the book on the drone war. He did all the great research on the drone war. And he was saying that there are, geez, I don't know the numbers he was saying, but he was saying that this is certainly the biggest air war since the invasion of Iraq, you know, Iraq 2 in 2003, certainly bigger than the air war over Libya in 2011. And we just, there is no Bernard Shaw in Mosul reporting, so we just don't even know. And that doesn't necessarily mean they're achieving anything necessarily. But.
And I would bet as a former intelligence officer that we don't know anything, that we don't have, that the only people we have on the ground are kind of in safe places where they're talking to Kurds or they're talking to the six or seven guys that are in the Free Syrian Army. And you know, and they're getting bullshit from all those people. And I would bet that's exactly what's going on.
Oh, careful, we're on the radio, but yeah. Yeah, well, you know, somebody in the chat room just posted this thing. I just heard back from a friend who works in the Pentagon, and I know this guy has a friend in the Pentagon. I've spoke with him before about this. After asking him about the new SecDef, he asked a couple coworkers who knew him and responded, quote, one colleague had him as a professor at Harvard, and another went to brief him on something while he was SecDef. Both said he was an arrogant, butt-sniffing prick. So...
Well, he's definitely going straight to the top then.
Yeah. Well,
no,
I saw
no question.
It. Yeah, no doubt about it. He co-wrote a paper on Iran's nuclear program with Michael Rubin, so I think we can all just
there you go.
Our,
that'll do it.
Absolutely. Any kind of happy future here. All right, we'll be right back. Phil Giraldi, it's anti-war radio, more or less here.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Okay, guys. Welcome back to the show. Last segment for the week here on the Scott Horton Show, Liberty Radio Network. Talking with Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest Foundation. And so, Phil, we're talking about Syria policy here mostly in terms of the new Iraq war, Islamic State war, and this and that. Is it really just up to Obama and Susan Rice to figure out what to do? And do they really have absolutely no idea what the hell they're doing over there? Because it seems to me like... I mean, and I know, and you know, I talk about this stuff, and I interview people like you every day on this show, so I'm much better immersed in it than many, maybe even than some on the National Security Council, I don't know. But it seems like any idiot could tell you George Bush started a giant sectarian civil war in the region over there, started in Iraq, he gave Baghdad to the Shiites, and now consequences. Then Obama goes, takes the side of the Mujahideen in Syria, makes it that much worse. But now, so here we are. We've got a guy calling himself Caliph Ibrahim. They swear they're at war with him, and yet they still are on the Saudi and really the Islamic State side in a de facto sense in Syria. And I'm wondering, is it really possible that this is all just such blundering and domestic politics that they can't even get it straight which side of a sectarian civil war they're on, or that they're not being cynical in playing both sides of it against each other?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I wish I could look inside Obama's head to see if there's anything functioning there. The fact is, it's just as you outlined it. There's basically no way to make sense out of this. Is probably partly politics. It's partly an attempt to seize the national security issue away from the Republicans, who, of course, come January are going to be beating on that drum constantly, by showing how tough the administration could be. I'm sure it's partly that. But what bothers me is we're getting back to the Hegel issue. What is the end game here? What they hope to accomplish, they as you noted, there's this huge conflagration taking place in the heart of the Arab world right now that we started. And is the solution to get rid of Assad? Is the solution, what is the solution? What is the solution they're looking for? And what do they expect to be the scenario or the series of scenarios that will replace this? I mean, I'm at a total loss for it. And I don't think I'm unique in that. I guess you're on a similar page, but I don't think anybody's figuring this out. If the administration had a coherent policy, it would be telling us that, wouldn't it? It would be in its own interest to tell us that. But the fact is, I just believe that what we're seeing here is a community organizer and his buddies. And they're sitting around, and they're responding in an ad hoc fashion to a series of crises that develop and continue to develop. And I don't think they have a clue about where this all goes.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, JDA in the chat room says that you only have to ask what the Likudniks want.
Well, of course, there's always that argument. But, of course, this is much bigger than that. It's there are a lot of Likudniks who are not necessarily just Likudniks. I mean, I'm doing a piece now for next week for Ons on how the military-industrial complex and everything fits in with all this kind of nonsense going on, and that's big bucks. And the real irony there is, of course, it's big bucks that come straight out of our pockets. So they're basically taking our money and then using our money to propagandize and propagate a war economy. There are a lot of clowns that are involved in this game, but the you know, the neocons are obviously the most visible, and
the Lockheed Knicks.
It's absolutely amazing.
Well, you know, there's that article by Richard Cummings, Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, where he traces all of the worst and the most famous, most infamous of the neocons of the Bush Jr. administrations to Lockheed, and how virtually all of them had represented Lockheed in one way or another, had sat on the board or something. The one furthest removed was Hadley, and he worked for the law firm that represented them and on their case. You know, it was Andrew Coburn that said that that's what really the neoconservative movement is. It's where the military-industrial complex, the post-World War II New Right, MIC money, where they met the Israel lobby. And they said, hey, we need intellectuals to come up with reasons to sell bombs, and you guys need money for your think tanks to create all your own little CFRs so that you guys can take over the policy. And they made their deal with the devil. That was back in, you know, 78 or whatever.
Yeah, well, like, for example, the American Enterprise Institute is largely funded by Grumman. The FBI is largely funded by Raytheon. I mean, it's just, you're right. I mean, let's work this out, because there's a lot of money to be made and there's a lot of stuff to be done by both of us. And it's depressing. That's to say the least.
Yeah. Well, and you know, just like our previous conversation with Ray McGovern on the show, I mean, messing around with the Islamic State is not quite as dangerous as messing around with the Russians. But then again, you see how much mileage they got out of 9/11. I mean, our government cynically exploiting it. You see how much mileage they get out of a couple of beheadings. If there was just a couple of terrorist attacks, you know, real Islamic State or inspired terrorist attacks inside this country, we could see a whole new level of Patriot Acts and red alerts and you know, Ferguson-level martial law on a regular basis in every town in this country. That's damn near as bad as a H-bomb.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've noticed the some of the pushback against the Rand Paul proposal to declare war on ISIS, you know, because that would create a mechanism for the United States government to lock up me and you and a whole lot of other people for being opposed to the war.
Right.
And declaring war is not, it seems like maybe a right way to go, but it ain't a solution. It just empowers the people that we don't want to empower.
Right. And of course, it gives the Islamic State a whole lot of credence that the government, you know, presumably would be trying to deny them, that really these guys are a bunch of heretics and gangsters and murderers. And just because they sacked Mosul doesn't make them a caliphate. And, you know, saying, yes, they are, in fact, a caliphate, and we declare war against them like we haven't done against any enemy since Nazi Germany, you know, and raising them to that level of enemy against us only does them a favor, like letting Khalid Sheikh Mohammed wear camouflage to court down in Cuba.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right. We are the ones that we created the mess in the first place, and we're empowering the very worst, you know, people that have surfaced out of this mess. And it's just absolutely astonishing that nobody in Washington seemingly can figure this out, or nobody who has the ability to change course on this can figure it out. It's just it's never ending. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I don't know if you remember that back in October of 2002, Ron Paul introduced a declaration of war in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and it was on C-SPAN. He instructed them all that he was going to vote against it, and he wanted them to all vote against it too. But if they were going to vote for war, he wanted them to take responsibility and declare war against Iraq instead of deferring the responsibility and giving it to George Bush. But that's not what Rand is doing. Rand is saying, yeah, let's declare war against the Islamic State. And then he's trying to add restrictions in his declaration of war, like, oh, but no ground troops and there's a time limit and that kind of thing, which if the whole thing passed, those parts would be null and void. You wouldn't be able to put those restrictions on a war.
Exactly. They would be overlooked into any subsequent developments. And the argument from the White House would be that, look, the situation has changed. Well, yeah, sure.
Right. Yeah, and of course, you know, it makes sense to challenge Congress that they should take responsibility for the war power. It's their responsibility. But you don't have to then say, yes, let me champion the actual passing of that resolution. You know what I mean? That's kind of a whole different question, you know?
Right,
whether
right.
it should happen or not. And of all of them in the U.S. Senate, he's the one who ought to know better. He's the one that we know he knows better because of whose son he is.
Yeah, and that's been the disappointment with Rand, that basically he seems to get the big picture, but he doesn't really figure out anything beyond that. And I don't know. It's just he still may well be the best Republican to surface in 2016. In fact, I'm sure he will be. But the fact is that he's going to be kind of a mixed blessing.
Yeah. Already has been in many ways. And at least I'm glad to hear, I actually hadn't heard of any of that pushback that you mentioned there. I'm glad to hear that I guess even the Hawks don't want a declaration of war, which would really be
exactly.
worse than authorization in many ways. As you said, it would make us all enemies of the state overnight in a World War I kind of way, like
right.
Bush and Ashcroft never did to us, as much as they scared the hell out of us.
Anyway. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thanks so much for your time, Phil. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. Take care. Bye.
All right, y'all. That's the great Phil Giraldi. The American Conservative and UNS.com.